Miami's hitting record lows in homicides that they only saw in the 60s. I think we're in a new reality where there are more champions and activists, and frankly, there are more survivors in Congress than there are the gun lobbyists, puppets. And I think that's a beautiful day, not because of the political side, but because that's what it's going to take for us to save lives. And I think that should be everyone's common goal.
And welcome to the Politics Girl podcast. I'm your host, Lee McGowan. Let's get into it. I feel like we've been talking so much about the election lately, so much about Donald Trump and his trials and the horse race with Joe Biden, and I thought it might be nice to take a step back and talk about the actual governing the Biden administration is doing to try and make the American people's lives better. Sometimes we need to take a break from all the criticism of government and acknowledge the importance of government, especially when they're doing good things. One of those good things was the recent creation of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Because as we watch people die to gun violence in our country every day, as we see America put on no travel list because of our gun violence epidemic, as we witness our suicide rates and accidental deaths by firearms grow exponentially, we clearly can't continue to do nothing. To talk about this new organization, I am joined today by Greg Jackson. Greg is the Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention and a Special Assistant to the President. A survivor of gun violence himself, Greg has been a gun violence prevention leader for over 10 years, leading the Community Justice Action Fund, a national survivor-led gun violence prevention organization. He has testified before Congress and regularly appeared on an array of media outlets, including Time, CNN, The Problem with Jon Stewart, The Washington Post, and the HBO documentary, The Price of Freedom. So without further ado, please welcome my guest, Deputy Director of the White House Office of Gun Prevention, Greg Jackson. Welcome, Greg.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh, thank you for joining me. I should start by paraphrasing Chris Brown, who's the president of Brady United Against Gun Violence. And she says, there are a few issues where the stakes are as high as gun violence and the steps to prevent them are so straightforward. So we know what we should be doing. And yet, here we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's so real how serious this issue is for our country and for so many Americans. And, you know, this is real for me. I'm a survivor of gun violence. And so I had that rude awakening 10 years ago when I was shot walking home. And there's nothing more eye-opening than being rolled into an emergency room and being told that you only have minutes to live, you know, if the surgery doesn't go through. I was alone and I was a rare case, but every year over 140,000 people are shot or killed. And so since I was shot, nearly a million people have gone through this nightmare, and it inspired me to action. I think it's inspired survivors all over the country, but it's definitely inspired our president to action. And I'm excited to talk more about the work that we're doing.
Yeah. 140,000 people die every year in this country from gun violence. And despite the fact that we know that reforming our laws would drastically cut those numbers down, and we've had endless political challenges to do anything about it just for decades. And now we have you guys at the Biden-Harris administration passing things like the Safer Communities Act, which was limited, but still the most significant piece of legislation that we've had in nearly 30 years. We've had a series of executive actions from President Biden himself. And then we have the creation of this new office that you are part of. So I'm really thrilled to be talking to you about this. Now, I just want to back up for a second because you just said that you yourself are a survivor of gun violence and that you were shot walking home. Could you just walk us through that a little bit more? Because I think most people, gun violence sometimes is something we see as a tragic case when you see these mass shootings that happen all over the country, or we know about the suicide rates, or we know about the shootings that happen accidentally in homes. But you're a personal survivor. So you wouldn't mind telling us sort of like where you came from into this work and where you came from to get involved here.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a night that so many of us can relate to. My cousins had come into town, was living in D.C. My cousins were from North Carolina in a small town and wanted to see the big city. And so we went out to have a Moroccan dinner and went out for drinks. And afterwards, we saw, you know, a lounge and said, hey, let's go over there and let's hang out. And so we went to the lounge, had a great time. And as we were leaving, walking to our car, two guys were in an argument. And we thought it was nothing. And as we were walking past, it exploded into gunfire and I was shot. And, you know, the bullet that hit me hit two arteries and I couldn't believe it happened. I didn't want to believe it happened. But then I found myself just fading in and out of consciousness and realizing that you know, I was fighting for my life in those moments, and I had to do all I could to stay calm. And then I was whisked away to the emergency room, and there I was met with investigators that questioned me and my whereabouts and why I was there and what role did I play. And I never forget that feeling, because I was so frustrated that I'm here trying to defend my innocence before I even knew what the damage was done, right? So after that, I was able to meet my surgeon, and he shared I only had about 26 minutes to live. And again, this bullet hit two arteries, so I was bleeding at a really fast pace. And I thought, you know, hey, all right, let's get this one surgery done and I'll get back on my feet and get back to life. But that wasn't the reality. I had to go through six different surgeries, took 6 months to learn how to walk again. And that trauma and pain is with me forever. You know, over $20,000 in hospital bills, had to leave my job, had to move from my apartment. My car got towed. I mean, I went through so much and actually had to move back in with my parents for a few months during my recovery. And I went from just, you know, a 20-year-old man, young man, living a good life, you know, trying to show my friends and family a good time to now fighting for my life and trying to figure out how to recover from this really tragic medical emergency. And, you know, all of that was so painful. But the one thing that really struck me was when I turned on CNN in my hospital room, and I saw legislators refusing to take action on the issue of gun violence, because I was shot 3 days after the failed Senate vote for universal background checks after the Sandy Hook tragedy. That was the all I needed, you know, to light that fire, to start taking action, because I saw firsthand that while people like me all over the country are going through these tragedies and fighting for our lives or losing our lives and losing our loved ones, our leaders in Washington just saw it as a political football and not something to take action and to prioritize. And so I made a commitment in my hospital room that if I ever get out of this bed, that I would do all I can to help change things. And I never thought I'd be in the White House, to be honest. But that commitment led to a lot of activism for me. And I know that moment of survivor is huge for so many people who've been impacted in their transition to activism.
Absolutely. And honestly, it's such a perfect example that you were an innocent bystander in someone else's altercation with firearms, because I think in many ways the country is an innocent bystander in a lot of people's interaction with firearms. I think it is not a choice that we have made. It is not something we are all just trying to live our good life. We're all trying to be out here doing something. And this violence is coming at us. Against our choice and against our will. And I think about how Trump is talking about in the future, if he gets back into office, he's going to have universal carry for everybody. And I think, no, that's going to bring me so many more Greg Jacksons struggling and doing what you had to do and going what you had to go through. And I think the majority of the people don't want that. So let's talk about your office. Let's talk about the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, because as I understand it, you are working on not just implementing the elements of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act and the executive actions taken in President Biden's first term, but you're just generally trying to make the country safer. Can you tell us what you're working on?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, this administration has seen this issue as a priority since day one. President Biden, actually, before he was formally inaugurated, acknowledged this as a public health crisis on December 21st of 2020, and the first president to see it as more than a crime crisis. And since day one, we've seen multiple executive actions, the first round in April of 2021. And amongst those dozens of executive actions, many of which are policy tweaks and resources for life-saving strategies, one huge spotlight was the passage of the Safer Communities Act, which you spoke of a little bit earlier. And this bill is huge because not only does it have key policy changes, it also released $15 billion for violence prevention strategies. It created things like the 988 Suicide Lifeline, $750 million for red flag laws to be implemented in states that have passed those laws, $250 million for violence intervention programs that can do gang and interpersonal intervention when there are those disputes amongst folks who share a community. But it also made very big changes to how we manage firearms in our country. It enhanced our background check system so that if you're under the age of 21, there's now two additional checks. They check on your mental health records and your juvenile history before approving that purchase. And to date, there's been over 600 denials, which is a 25% increase in denials of purchasers under 21 since this law was passed in the summer of 2022. And this is huge because we actually went through the stories and we saw some really scary stories, to be frank. I mean, we had someone who was attempting to buy an assault weapon. And when they did that check on their mental health records, found out that he had been involuntarily placed in an institute for suicidal ideation and posting online about wanting to take his own life. But if that enhanced check wasn't there, he would have that assault weapon waiting for him when he returned home. Another person we saw that was attempting to buy firearms, when we called local law enforcement, we found out that he was incarcerated for attempted murder. And so if he had gotten out on bail, frankly, he would have had guns, legal guns, waiting for him at the store after that background check. And so these 570 plus denials are huge, but that's one major part of the bill. I think one other huge thing that we like to highlight, it actually the largest investment in youth mental health in American history, adding 14,000 school-based mental health professionals to our public school system. And that's huge because we only have 40,000 right now. So once these dollars are fully implemented, we'll have a 35% increase in individuals that can provide a helping hand to children and youth that are in crisis. And then the last big thing, which I'm really fired about to highlight, is for the first time we make gun trafficking a federal offense. And this bill actually creates four strike forces that are now working to go out and find those who are buying guns for profit and putting them in the hands of those who are most vulnerable, whether that's youth or communities that are being most impacted by violence. And so this historic bill was huge for us to start thinking, how do we prevent violence before it happens and before that gun is drawn? And then also, how do we get dollars to work to save lives? And so our first big charge as an office is to expedite the implementation of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act and the president's executive actions. Yes, we know implementation will happen and can happen eventually, but our team is helping to make sure it's getting done as fast as humanly possible, knowing that every day that passes that these tools aren't at work, that lives are being lost. Our second big charge is to identify new solutions and new ideas to address gun violence. And so we're looking at, okay, is there more that agencies can do? Is there more that the policy can do? Are there dollars that are being unused that we can apply to this effort? Or can we just focus and channel our resources to strategies or communities that are most impacted? And we're starting to already see some pretty great success. One innovative thing is we rolled out a big safe storage of firearms awareness campaign with the Department of Education. And this is huge because I think when we think about school shootings and youth suicide and a lot of the violence that happens across the country, we often think about it as, you know, a boogeyman alley, you know, selling a gun, or somebody at a gun show that hands someone an assault weapon. But when we look at the statistics, 76% of school shootings, the guns come from the home. And when we look at youth suicide, 80% of those guns come from the home. And unintentional shootings and accidental injuries, 76% of those come from the home. And so this safe storage campaign is focused on how do we start to educate parents, teachers, and adults, frankly, on how to safely and securely store their firearms so that we can start to slow down this access problem that we know is fueling a lot of the violence across the country. So the Department of Education actually charged every public school principal and every superintendent in the country to start leaning in on this issue and provided resources and materials to educate and provided even a toolkit and draft letters to send to parents, because we knew that parents and teachers want to be a part of the solution and not just reacting with active shooter drills and reacting to tragedy, but starting to be proactive. And we're starting to give them tools to do that. So that's one example of our new solutions that we're identifying. Our team is also figuring out how do we better respond to tragedies. I'm standing here in front of a picture of the vice president and the second gentleman as they were in Buffalo. And one terrible thing about Buffalo was that despite all of the media coverage, despite all the trauma and the tragedy, the community was left to pick up the pieces alone. And this shouldn't be that way.
Shooting that happened in the grocery store in Buffalo.
Yes, in Buffalo. And we saw the same thing in Uvalde. We saw the same thing in the Brooklyn Homes community in Baltimore, where 28 teens were shot last summer, where when these tragedies happen, we solve the case and the communities, unfortunately, are left to pick up the pieces. And it wouldn't be that way if there was a natural disaster or terrorist attack. And so what this office is building out is the first ever FEMA-style emergency response system that can deploy mental health resources, that can deploy additional law enforcement support, that can deploy, you know, emergency loans for small businesses, or even just staff and expertise to help the community recover from these tragedies. And we're excited to be able to offer that. This morning, we had a call with the mayor's team in Philadelphia after their tragic bus shooting. And we're there to help these communities, not weeks later or days later, but hours later, and not just with talk, but with resources.
Yeah. It's so essential. And you also seem to be coordinating among multiple agencies, using the Department of Education, using the different departments that have secretaries of their own that are in the cabinet, that you can kind of coordinate these efforts. And if people don't know, gun violence is the leading cause of death in children in America. And statistics tell us that approximately 4.6 million children live in homes with unsecured firearms. So what Greg is talking about here, this promoting the safe storage of firearms and helping schools tell families how they can safer store these firearms, this is so your gun in your nightstand or your gun in your purse doesn't end up shooting your child or having them shoot their brother or this kind of thing. Because the statistics Greg were giving, I mean, 76% of school shootings are committed with guns that people got at home. 80% of guns in suicides children got from their own homes. 76% of unintentional shootings of children happen from guns that are just unsecured in their own homes. And to be really clear, those suicide numbers of children under the age of 18 in America has gone up almost 70%. In the last 10 years. These kids are not okay. The people in America are not okay. And we're giving them the ability to take a very final solution very quickly without thinking about a better way to help them prevent it and help them make different choices and give them different options. Unsecured firearms also mean that guns get stolen far more often. And they're also stolen by people who can't get guns legally. So then they are gone on to be used in crimes. Between 2017 and 2021, over 1 million guns were stolen in America, with the biggest rising trend being firearms stolen from unattended vehicles, because now everyone wants to have a gun in their car, right? So this idea behind the executive actions and these choices and these coordinations with different parts of the government are trying to help less accidents happen, but also less crimes happen with these guns. And I'll tell you, Greg, you know, I've personally believed for a long time that guns in America should have to be not only registered, but that people should be held personally responsible. Like, we should have liability for our weapons, because if a toddler takes a gun out of your purse and shoots his brother, I really do believe it should be as if you pull the trigger. If your teenage son takes your gun to school and shoots 8 people, I personally think you should be responsible for those teenage deaths. If your gun accidentally goes off and kills your granddaughter, you should be held responsible. Because I think if we were held responsible either financially or legally for what happens with our personal weapons, people would get really serious really fast about what real safe storage was, what really locking up, what really being a responsible gun owner was. Because we're starting to see this a little bit more with, like, those parents being held responsible for their teenager using the gun, and Ethan Crumbly's parents are now being held responsible. He's a 15-year-old. If you guys don't know him, he committed a mass shooting in Michigan's Oxford High School a few years ago. And the judge sent the boy to prison for life. But in February of 2024, his mother was said to be held responsible. She shares responsibility with her son. And she was found guilty on 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. And his father still faces charges. So I feel like this is the next important step. If we really start holding people responsible for things that happen with their personal weapons, and this idea of what a responsible gun owner looks like is going to change. Because I think that it's not that we want to ever take away people's guns. That was never the goal. It's not this thing that we've been told for years, this boogeyman idea that we're coming for your guns. It's not that. You know, people have said for years, oh, well, cars kill people. Does that mean we're going to take away all cars? And you're like, no, we're not going to take away all cars. But we did pass laws to make cars safer. We mandated everything from seatbelt airbags to backup cameras and speed limits and alcohol tests and this kind of thing. We did these steps to make sure you had to be a certain age. You took a driver's test. Your license can expire. If you behave badly with your license, it can be taken away. These limits didn't regulate cars. They just made driving safer for everyone. And I think we have to be really serious about the fact that we have all these unregistered, unsecured guns across America. And then we look at America and we go, well, we've got a real problem. So what are we going to do about it? And so your office is out here saying, okay, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. And I think the big thing is, you know, we know that accountability is important, but we also have to make sure people are aware of what responsible gun ownership is. I mean, I literally had a friend. I was at her house and her neighbor was bragging about how he has guns on every floor of the home and that they're hidden. And we found the gun within 2 minutes. It was sitting in a wooden tissue box on the coffee table, right? Now imagine if I had to blow my nose, or if I was 6 years old and I had a runny nose and I found a revolver with bullets. I mean, we have to educate people on what does safe storage look like. It's not just hiding the gun. It's getting a cable lock, putting it in an actual lock box, separating the ammunition from the actual gun. Like, these are key things that sound simple to those who are familiar and have had guns their whole lives and maybe come from that type of family. But the reality is we've seen a huge surge in new gun owners, a huge surge of people who are buying guns for the first time, whether it's out of fear or you know, manipulative marketing. But that community has to be educated, because in their own way, they're fueling this cycle of violence by not securing their firearms. And so our office is focused on education, making sure that the actual tools are accessible, understanding that accountability is important, but we have a responsibility to do all three.
Absolutely. I think we also should be really clear why the president has had to do a lot of these changes through things like executive order. And it's because we can't get more legislation through Congress because the Republicans refuse to help. So President Biden is using the power he does have with the hope of making a difference, but also so that once these laws are established, they're far more difficult to roll back. They become part of the community. They become part of what we do. They become part of the vernacular of how we talk about weapons and guns. Oh, with safe storage, this kind of thing. But also, I really want everyone to understand that there is one party in America actively trying to make our country safer when it comes to gun violence, and one party that is standing in the way. And I don't think we can pretend that's not happening, because we have heard for years from Republican politicians and organizations like the NRA that any form of gun regulation is an infringement on the law-abiding gun owner, and it's an infringement on the Second Amendment. And they try to equate any kind of regulation with a ban, which takes me back to my car analogy, right? Like, it's not a ban. We have lots of people die in car accidents every year, even though we have put all these regulations in place to make cars safer. But that number would be infinitely higher without the safety precautions we've put in. And I think any sane American can see that to make changes to strengthen our gun laws and enforcement and make gun violence in America far more rare, we have to make these changes. We have to take these steps. We have to actually do something. I think, as Biden said when he opened your office of gun prevention, thoughts and prayers are just not enough. Did you know your temperature at night has one of the greatest impacts on the quality of your sleep? If you're one of those people who wakes up too hot or too cold, then I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made bedsheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics to make temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Miracle Made silver-infused sheets are not only thermoregulating, but also prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times longer than other sheets. Plus, they're just really nice. Great, high-quality bedding without that obscenely high price. Go see for yourself. Go to trymiracle.com/politicsgirl to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo code politicsgirl at checkout, you will get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep today with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/politicsgirl and use the code politicsgirl to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that is trymiracle.com/politicsgirl to treat yourself. And I want to thank Miracle Made for continuing to sponsor the Politics Girl podcast. The older I get, the more I find myself wanting to be more intentional about the way I live and eat and take care of my body. Everything I can do to keep myself from falling apart and keep my mind and body running smoothly, I'm going to try. I have talked about Mosh Bars before. Mosh is a company founded by Maria Shriver and her son Patrick Schwarzenegger with a simple mission: to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Mosh joined forces with the world's top scientists and functional nutritionists to make something beyond your average protein bar. Each Mosh bar is made with the ingredients that support brain health, like lion's mane, collagen, and omega-3s. And with 6 delicious flavors, each bar also gives you 12 grams of protein. Plus, they also have a line of plant-based protein bars, if that's how you eat. Now, I've been so busy lately that I've been eating Mosh Bars all the time. I just run out of time to eat, and I know that if I can at least get a Mosh Bar into my body, I won't be running completely on fumes. I keep one in my bag. I have them in my office. They're an essential part of my, you know, non-balanced life. I love them. My favorites are the lemon and white chocolate and both peanut butter crunch ones. And here's the best part. Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Two-thirds of all Alzheimer's patients are women, and Mosh is working closely to close that gap between men and women's health research. This is a personal mission for Maria. Her father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding ways to help other families dealing with this debilitating disease. So if you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and brain, Mosh Bars are the perfect choice. Head to moshlife.com/politicsgirl to save 20% off plus free shipping on your first 6-count trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on your first 6-count trial pack. moshlife.com/politicsgirl. Today's podcast is brought to you by Honeylove, who have revolutionized the bra game. They were the ones that said, why do we have to have this horrible underwire and bulky fabrics that don't breathe? And they created bras that give you the lift without the hardware. It's next level comfortable, and I have no doubt you will feel the difference. As I said before, I could probably get away with not wearing a bra, but I have friends that literally sleep in their bras, which is why I'm really pleased to recommend Honeylove's best-selling crossover bra. It is super comfortable with all the support, but it's also kind of sexy. I wear mine with their fantastic matching shapewear, and I don't feel like I'm wearing some weird grandmother girdle or like I'm a giant sausage. I also have to tell you that Honeylove just came out with an incredible line of leggings. They're smooth, they're soft, they're high enough in the waist so that kind of holds it all together, and there's no seam in the middle where the legs come together. And I know if you're a girl who knows leggings, then you know what I'm talking about, and it's not cute. These leggings are so good, and I highly recommend you check them out. I love them. So treat yourself to the best bras on the market and the most fabulous leggings and save 20% off at honeylove.com/politicsgirl. Use our exclusive link to get 20% off at honeylove.com/politicsgirl. And after you buy, if they ask you where you heard about them, please support the show and tell them that we sent you. Treat yourself to Honeylove, because let's be honest, we kind of deserve it. honeylove.com/politicsgirl. As Biden said when he opened your office of gun prevention, thoughts and prayers are just not enough.
No, they really aren't. And unfortunately, you know, in my work over the past 10 years, I've met so many survivors and so many families. We went down to Lewiston, Maine, and this wasn't televised, but the president sat down with every family that lost someone, with the exception of two, because I think they were in funeral services, but every family. And we sat with them for hours, just to hear them out and to hear about the pain, but also to honor the legacy of those who were lost from such a senseless shooting. I can't imagine what it would be like to sit there and say, okay, well, you know, get over it. Or like what the previous administration shared, like this president genuinely wants to take action. And when these families say, we need you to do something, with tears in their eyes and photos of their loved ones, this president means business when he says we're going to do something. And that's the energy that he brings to us and to our office. I mean, we have a meeting in the West Wing every morning at 9:10 a.m. And we're specifically working through how are we reacting and responding to recent tragedies, and then how are we moving the ball forward on all of these policies? Because we all know that we care about those who have been lost and harmed and impacted. But I mean, I think that the true signal of how much you care is how much you're willing to change things and how much work you're willing to put in. And that's exactly what this administration is doing. And maybe we're not on social media every day, but we are working tirelessly every day. I mean, we left here at midnight yesterday. The day before that, we left at 11. I mean, we're here as long as we possibly can, because we just know that this crisis is impacting our communities every day, that loss is happening every day. And if we can inch the ball forward on any of these policies or resources to communities, then we can save lives. And that's something that we think is a way to honor those folks beyond the thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're also dealing with a president who understands loss and understands losing people. And I think that type of empathy is so useful when you're a leader. Because like you said, the previous administration just made a speech that said, you know, yes, there was a violent shooting and yes, this happened and yes, people lost their loved ones, but like, we got to move on. We got to move forward. And if you're a person who's lost your loved one in America, it doesn't matter if it was to gun violence, but lost them early, you understand you don't just move on from that kind of loss. You're not like, well, and now, no, that's not how it works. I think that it's so essential that we start looking at this unnecessary deaths and we say, you know what, no more, we don't want this. And these changes have been so difficult because of all the lies and the half-truths and the myths that have been fed to us from the gun industry to sell as many guns as possible. We have to be honest, it's a capitalistic kind of dream, no matter the cost. And that, I mean, no matter the cost, is like, well, your children's lives are, you know, the price of our guns. And I think, no, that's not what I'm willing to pay. And I think that's not what most people are willing to pay. Now, I understand you guys have also launched the Safer States Initiative to reduce gun violence and save lives at the states level. So would you talk me through what's going on with that program?
Yeah, no, this is exciting. So we know that, unfortunately, we aren't seeing the progress in Congress that we want to see and we know America needs. But we've also paid attention that so many states are taking action and they're changing policies in their own ways, whether that's banning assault weapons in their state, whether that's investing in community violence intervention, or places like North Carolina, where they created their first own statewide Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Just yesterday, Louisiana introduced legislation to create their own office. And so we're seeing all this movement at the state level. So the president said, hey, we got to get in the game and help them as much as possible. And so we built out what we call our Safer States Initiative. And we brought together legislators from 39 states to come to the White House to share what's working, what challenges they're facing, and highlight some of the states that are seeing tremendous progress, even in some of the toughest political climates. And as part of that, we also rolled out our Safer States agenda, which is, you know, our recommendations of what we think can be done to address this crisis. And there are 14 policy specifications in there, everything from creating trauma recovery centers to help communities after the tragedy, to looking at what can we can do around safe storage, lost and stolen guns. But it's a full spectrum of solutions to address this crisis. And many of those solutions in there are bipartisan, and some of them were Republican proposed. And so we think this package itself is something that can help states across the country. And since then, we've been working with different state leaders, helping them develop their public safety package or violence reduction strategies. And we've seen 27 of those 39 states advance legislation in a major way. And we're excited as state legislators are ending their session soon, we'll start to see which one of those bills pass and what changes can we see and celebrate. But we are just so excited about all of the energy. I mean, this was actually the largest convening of state legislators for the entire term of this administration. They came because of this issue of gun violence. And I think while we may not see the energy or the enthusiasm in Washington, it's very clear at the city and state level that this is a top issue that folks are ready to get to work on. And so we're excited to partner in those efforts.
That's marvelous. And also we should note the 11 states that stayed home on that issue, right? There are states that really do not care. And I think we need to be really clear. Those states all have the same leadership. So it's a lot of things that you guys are doing. And I'm just going to walk people through a couple of things because you were just saying them. Like, you're establishing state offices of gun violence prevention, and it's about funding community violence interventions and funding law enforcement initiatives to kind of hold shooters and gun traffickers truly accountable for what they've done. Like you said, implementing red flag orders, which are also, for people to know, they're also called extreme risk protection orders, which allow certain individuals to petition the courts to temporarily remove access to guns from someone who is in a crisis. Like you said, we're going to strengthen support for survivors and victims of gun violence, including these trauma recovery centers that you're talking about, establishing these gun violence response teams to help communities, like you were saying, really deal with it the way we would a natural disaster. You know, like, these communities are torn apart by this kind of violence. And instead of just being like, well, you're on your own, sorry about that, these are offices that will really help and bring funds and expertise to people who really need it in their time of crisis, because it's very overwhelming to people. And it also feels like it's about states putting in stronger laws and programs in in place that would impose kind of a clear standard of what the penalties would be for people who don't follow the law, right? Like if you don't correctly store your weapon and it ends up being used for violence. And I think any kind of accountability like that is good because it kind of changes the dynamic. And you were talking earlier about one of the things in the Safer Communities Act is these expanded background checks for individuals under 21, right? And how effective that's being. And just so people understand, this has allowed the FBI to kind of look into any relevant juvenile mental health records, state records, and it's been working to make sure these guns don't fall into the wrong hands. And these background checks, they've kind of denied firearm sales to people under 21 by 25% who really were deemed unsafe to be buying or purchasing a firearm. And that is amazing because that really changes the violence that can happen to people. These are usually the boys that commit mass shootings, these young boys that go into schools, this kind of thing. But the states could help out a lot here if we're talking about the states, because I know Congress has only given the ATF the resources to inspect about 10% of gun dealers every year, which leaves 90% kind of unchecked. And the states could really help out with that.
Yeah. And
fill in those blanks.
Definitely. I mean, the states can help. We also need more resources for the ATF. I mean, we're fighting hard to make sure that they have the resources to hold folks accountable, whether it's, you know, reining in rogue gun dealers, finding and prosecuting gun traffickers, but also doing those very critical inspections to ensure that those who are selling firearms are obeying the law. And I think that's something that no matter where you are on the aisle, you can celebrate and support that we need stronger laws, stronger accountability, but we also need to protect this culture that means so much to so many people by ensuring that those who are selling firearms are being responsible. I did want to just share one other big thing. You know, as excited as we are about the progress we're making, you know, it is real for us every day that we're losing so many people. And unfortunately, in the wake of these tragedies, we're seeing so many new activists. And we're saddened by it, but we're also inspired by how we're seeing so many new folks take action. And this movement of organizations that are fighting to prevent gun violence continues to grow and grow. And we went from a world where maybe there was one or two organizations trying to take on the NRA or take on the gun lobby. And now there are thousands of organizations and millions, frankly, of activists and survivors. And so for those folks who are tuning in, I just want to thank you for all of your hard work as a fellow survivor and a fellow activist, that a lot of the change we're seeing is only possible because of that pressure and because of that activism. And it starts at the local level. It's happening in states. And now you're seeing it with this administration happen in the White House.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, gun violence has been a huge and growing problem in America for decades. And it's always felt like there was so little we could do about it between the NRA lobbyists and the Republican pandering to them. And there was this period of time, we had like 20 years where we couldn't even use federal funding to do research on gun violence because of something called the Dickey Amendment, which was passed in 1996, which prevented federal funds being allocated to promote gun control, which was essentially meant that we eliminated all funding for any gun-related research. And then you add to that the lapsing of the assault weapons ban in 2004, and we found ourselves in this country where, as we were saying, the number one cause of childhood death is now gun violence, and we've become the land of mass shootings, right? So it's infuriating, especially since the majority of this country wants it to be different, and we want common sense legislation, and we don't want to be afraid going to movies or concerts or Super Bowl parades or, you know, anything that we do. We don't want to live in a world of fear. That's not freedom. And we talk so much about freedom in America. And if you're constantly terrified of going anywhere, that's not free. We're not free. Does it feel different to you working in this office under this particular administration and this leadership than it has over, say, the past 20 years?
I mean, I think we've made tremendous strides. And you speak of the 20-year mark. I mean, I just think back to May 4th in 2000 when George Bush Jr. was elected, and the NRA president told the members that we will now, with this new president, we will be working out of the White House. The NRA was bragging about that. And that was 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago. And now I'm tuning in to you, literally standing in the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, surrounded by a president and vice president and survivors and activists and youth who have been impacted, literally hanging from the walls while we fight forward to advance this change. And it is extremely inspiring. I mean, we saw last year a 12.4% reduction in homicides across the country. We're starting to see some cities see drastic reductions. I mean, Miami's hitting record lows in homicides that they only saw in the 60s. I mean, a lot of the work is happening. A lot of the impact is being felt. And frankly, a lot of the lives are being saved. And that's not happening by accident. That's happening because of life-saving resources, because of policy changes that are working. And really, most of all, the spirit of the American people to not just give in to this culture of gun violence that has dominated and consumed our lives. And we know that we should be safe in our schools. We know that we should be safe in our churches and in our neighborhoods and in our backyards and in our homes. And the American people have decided we're not going to sit here and wait for the next tragedy. We're going to speak up and push for action. We're going to speak up and demand change. And if folks aren't willing to do that, then we're going to run for office and be that change, like Representative Maxwell Frost here in Congress. And so I think we're in a new reality where there are more champions and activists, and frankly, there are more survivors in Congress than there are the gun lobbyists, puppets. And I think that's a beautiful day, not because of the political side, but because that's what it's going to take for us to save lives. And I think that should be everyone's common goal.
I mean, from the beginning to end of what you just said, it's all about we the people, right? We the people are done with this. We the people are voting for something different than this. We the people are choosing legislators and community leaders that are going to make our lives safer, that say this is enough and we've had enough and we don't want this. Yeah. And we have to put leadership in those positions. We are not powerless. And I think people need to remember that. We are not powerless. We can create these grassroots groups, support these grassroots groups, support politicians that support common sense gun legislation. This has never been about taking from anyone. It's about expanding our freedom to live a life of happiness and safety in a nation that we should feel safe and we currently do not. And I just want to thank you for the work that you do, Greg. I want to thank the administration for making this a serious issue that we're addressing. And I want to thank you for joining us. So please tell us how people can keep up with your work and what we can do to help with gun violence prevention in our own homes and our own lives.
Yeah. Well, I'm so excited. This week, we just launched our social media handles. Oh, and so we are
okay.
Now.
Okay, new social media. Tell me about it.
So we're on Instagram. You can follow us at White House OGVP46. There's only a few White House accounts, so we shouldn't be too hard to find. And then on Twitter or X, we are at WHOGVP. And there you'll start to see more about some of these life-saving and historic announcements that we're starting to make. And if you're thinking about how you can take action, I think there's really three things you can do. One is just don't give in to fear. Be that brave voice that speaks out for change, that breathes life into a world that's always talking about death and despair. Inspire those around you that we can change this. And this doesn't have to be our reality. And just that mentality shift is a huge way. And I'm sure you'll identify solutions in your own way to help us with this issue. Secondly, make sure you're holding your own family and community accountable, making sure that they're securely storing their firearms if they do decide to purchase a gun, that they're thinking about the risks that are involved, and that they're thinking about what is the actual goal. Are we protecting our homes and families, or are we buying into this culture that we know has been destroying so many lives? And so holding your circle accountable is huge. And then lastly, we really hope that you'll help us push forward on a lot of these policy changes. There are many things that we can do at the city level, at the state level, and here in Washington. And we need your voices. We need you to speak loud and clear about what you want to see and who you want to lead for you to address this crisis, knowing that we're fighting as hard as we can inside this building, but we need the community to be a part of every solution that we're fighting for. So we're excited to join forces with you. We'll see you online and on the internet. And just thank you so much for having me on the podcast. This has really been a pleasure. So
Greg,
I've enjoyed
thank
it.
You so much. I think we just have to remember that there's more people out here who believe in positive change, who believe in sensible gun legislation. And I want you guys to know that we have your backs and we're going to work really hard to elect people who will push for this kind of change and support what you're doing. Because literally enough is enough. And most of us just can't take it anymore.
Literally. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
So that was Greg Jackson, reminding us that we aren't powerless to address gun violence in this country and that this administration has our backs. He leaves us with three things. Don't give in to fear. Be that brave voice and inspire those around you to know it doesn't have to be like this. hold your people accountable for safe behavior around firearms, and finally, help those in government who are trying to push safer legislation forward. Be loud and clear about what you want everywhere from your dining room table to the voting booth. I want to thank Greg for joining us today and you for caring enough about democracy to be here. Now go and check out the Office of Gun Prevention's Insta or Twitter and stay informed. Until next week, PG out. The Politics Girl podcast is written and performed by me, Lee McGowan, in partnership with the Midas Media Network, and produced and edited by Happy Warrior Entertainment. All rights reserved.